ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For the first time in over 50 years, astronauts will soon fly around the moon.
They're ready to fly.
But there are real concerns about their safety.
We're playing Russian roulette.
In our series, The Challenger Legacy, we trace the history of two space shuttle disasters. And we ask, what are the lessons for today?
I'm Karl Kuschelnitsky.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Binge all the episodes now. Just search for The Challenger Legacy on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week, one of the most downloaded apps in Australia wasn't a game, a social network, or even an AI tool. It was a virtual private network, or VPN. Actually, several VPNs. They shot up the App Store charts at speeds we've not seen before. VPNs have been around for decades, and plenty of people use them for completely legitimate reasons. Privacy, security on public Wi-Fi, accessing work records remotely. But a lot of the people who downloaded one this week had never done it before, grabbed the first free option they found, and may not realise that some of those free tools carry real risks of their own. So, what does a VPN actually do? Why is everyone using them all of a sudden? And how do you find one that actually protects you rather than creating new problems? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter for all of us is Professor Michael Cowling, who is a Professor of Educational Technology at RMIT and also the Director of the Hub for Apple Platform Innovation. We're going to call him Professor Tech. Welcome, Professor Tech.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
And also Tobias Venus, who is a tech and travel journalist. Welcome, Tobias.
Hello. Absolutely not a professor.
Neither am I. No. Neither am I. Okay, so as age verification laws came into effect this week, VPNs became the most popular apps and downloads for people across the country. Professor Tech, Michael, we'll start with you. What actually is a VPN? How does it work?
Look, it depends how technical you want me to get. I suppose in the not so technical way, it's a tunneling protocol. Right. So the idea of a VPN is that you connect to a server somewhere, in this case, somewhere probably not in Australia, and then all of your traffic goes through that server. And that means that other people like the government or the people that are doing the age restriction can't see that traffic, because from their point of view, you're just sending traffic to this VPN wherever it is. It then gets routed through the system and then out the other end and traffic coming back to you.
So the VPN hides where you really are.
That's exactly right. And that's why people often use them for getting, say, American Netflix or UK Netflix as opposed to Australian Netflix. You just tell it, I'm in the US, and it makes it look like you're in the US or the UK.
So, Tobias, why were so many people downloading VPNs this week?
The short answer is adult websites.
Okay.
Australia has just introduced new age verification rules for sites that host adult material. So instead of clicking, yes, I'm over 18, platforms now need to properly verify users, which can involve things like facial age checks or even uploading your ID to a third-party verification service.
So to avoid uploading your personal information, such as your driver's license, your password, or have these sites gather your biometric data, like your face scan, for instance, and have that connected with your adult website usage, which is something I can't imagine many people would want happening, everyone started downloading VPNs. So the Australian VPN downloads, I was looking this up, across the major providers, they nearly tripled to over 28,000 of them in March.
Overnight.
So this feels like a predictable outcome of age verification laws. Should we have expected this to happen, Michael?
Definitely. And look, in other places where they've done this type of age verification, they've had a similar spike in VPN use because you're right. There's, I think, if you demonize it, you presume it's all the people that are under the age of 18 that want to do it. But I think you're right. It's also grown-ups or adults that just don't want to share that information. I'm not sure that I'd want to share my driver's license with the kinds of websites that people are going to. You just don't want to share that information. It's a privacy thing. So I'm not surprised. And it has happened across the UK and various other places that they've implemented those laws.
It's one of the things that we spoke about a lot as well when talking about the social media ban. The kids are just going to use a VPN to skirt these laws. And I think that's something that's probably very likely happening at the moment. There are risks that come with using some VPNs, though. Free VPNs went to the top of the charts this week. What are the risks involved in downloading a free VPN, Tobias?
As the old saying goes, if something is free, you are the product. So running a VPN is expensive. So if you're not paying for it, the company still needs to make money somehow to run all this stuff. So some free VPNs have been caught logging user activity, injecting ads, or even selling browsing data to third parties. Just looking at the App Store this morning, looking at the top free apps, the number two free app is one which definitely does track a lot of what you do. If you're looking at these sites through this VPN, it might not be the best course of action. Also, I just noted the first and third app in the charts this morning. Number one is Petrol Watch, and number three is ChatGPT. So really painting a picture of what 2026 is all about.
Fantastic. So yeah. I do find it a little bit ironic, actually, that people are downloading VPNs to give themselves some privacy, but they're trading privacy to use free VPNs. How do we know that our VPN is safe, Michael, that it's protecting our information?
Look, the honest truth is that if you're paying for it, often the pay providers NordVPN, and I'm sure Tobias has got a list of a couple of others as well that are popular paid providers, they'll tell you explicitly that they don't share your data because that's how they make their money and that's why they think they can charge you $20 or $30 a month for the system. So I guess my advice to people that were listening would be just look for those reliable, reputable VPNs. And as Tobias said, if you're not paying for it, there's probably a reason why they're trading your information.
Ideally, they've also been audited by like a third party to make sure that they're not collecting your logs and selling them to other people. It's all well and good for them to say it on their website. Some of the free ones do. But you really need like a third party to look at this stuff and let you know that, yes, these guys are legit.
If you were to recommend using a VPN to anyone in your life, how would you go about it? What guidelines would you give them?
Make sure they don't collect logs. Make sure they're independently audited and make sure that it's paid. I don't think there's any free ones out there that'll be right for you.
The UK, France, a few US states, they ran similar laws, similar age verification laws. They saw the same kind of VPN surge as well. What do you think that pattern tells us about how well this kind of legislation actually works in practice?
When it comes to adult content, the internet is very good at rooting around restrictions. I don't think it means the policy doesn't have an impact, though. I think having a block in place kind of at least prevents that first line where maybe an adult or a child is accidentally coming across adult content. That's a good thing that we're protecting people against that. But it does show that regulating behaviour online isn't as simple as just passing a law. You need to put a bit more thought behind it.
Michael, there are suggestions that VPN access itself could eventually be age-gated, that there would be age verification technology built in to the services that people are using to avoid age verification technology. This is technically possible, right?
Definitely, because you ultimately need a username and password. You need to sign up for the VPN system. And once you sign up for it, then you can add in the age verification the same way as you can for the adult websites or the social media or whatever it might be. I like Tobias's argument, though. I think ultimately this does increase the barrier to entry. And I think that is a good thing. I think we do it with other things like smoking and drinking and gambling. But I think another important part of it, which we also do for smoking and drinking and gambling, is is educating people, because ultimately people are going to try and get around this. And if you just put in those blocks, those technical blocks, then you just end up playing a game of cat and mouse. So I think educate people, teach people about digital literacy and safety. But that's my drum that I always bang on.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And I'm joined by Professor Tech himself, Michael Cowling, who is a professor of educational technology at RMIT and also the director of the Hub for Apple Platform Innovation. And Tobias Venus, who is a technology and travel journalist. And online creators are using generative AI to churn out misinformation and disinformation about the war in Iran. And they are making money while they're doing it. So, Tobias, what kinds of fake content have been circulating? What are we talking about exactly here?
There's a lot. There's three main types. We've got AI-generated war scenes. Great. Old clips from previous conflicts being reposted as if they're new, and even video game footage being passed off as real conflict. So there's a lot of dramatic footage getting spread very quickly before anyone has time to verify it, which is causing real stress and confusion amongst people who live in these places or have family there.
Absolutely. And yeah. And I think when you're seeing this kind of content, and it's incredibly emotive, and we are in conflict, so it does fit with what we know about what is happening in the world right now, it creates some really difficult situations. So let's go back to the idea of misinformation and disinformation for a moment. What is the difference between the two, and which are we mostly looking at here?
Okay, so misinformation, false information shared by people who believe it's real. The example I like to use is when your mate at the pub starts explaining flat earth theory.
Right.
Disinformation is different. That's false information shared deliberately to mislead people, like when Australians tell tourists that a drop bear is real.
What has changed in recent years, you know, since we saw those terrible videos of Will Smith eating spaghetti poorly? what has changed about AI-generated footage that makes this a harder problem than it was during previous conflicts that we've seen on social media?
I think this is an escalation of what we've known for a while, which is that a lot of young people use social media and these kinds of mechanisms to get their news. I used to say that I found out Michael Jackson had died because I read it on Facebook, I think, at the time, or Twitter at the time. And younger people do that even more than I do. I'm not quite a young person. But and so the extension of that is that if you want to make some money online, you generate these kinds of videos. And I think we've done that for a while. Fake news has been a thing for a while. But what's changed is that the tools have gotten better at generating this kind of video, both for fun, but also for this kind of disinformation. But disinformation for profit, it is all about them making money by posting those videos and collecting money from the social networks for getting views and likes.
So how exactly are people making money? Are they making a lot of money? Do we have any idea about how this is actually working as a job for people, which when you look at it, technically, they've made this their job, which is bizarre, Tobias.
I work with social media a lot, and it's the same way that I would make money off social media. It's just the incentive structure of those platforms. So if you have a lot of views, like shares and comments, you're rewarded for that. Unfortunately, dramatic war footage performs incredibly well in that environment because people are sharing it if they believe it's real, or they're arguing that it's not real in the comments. So it's just creating a lot of engagement. All of that engagement basically shows to the platforms that you're worth spending money on, and then you can start earning money through ad revenue, creator payments, or simply by sending people to your website to sell them whatever your product is. Through all those views.
Surely the platforms have a responsibility here to shut this down, to stop people from making money from AI-generated war videos.
Yes, you would think so. I know Meta, for one, decided to kind of go hands-off with all that stuff quite recently. I imagine X is the same. I'm not really sure exactly what they're doing these days to prevent that stuff.
I believe that there is zero moderation on X. It's not something that they engage in. But we've had these social media companies dragged in front of courts over things like this before, Michael.
Yeah, indeed. And look, I think generally the messaging that we get from social media, especially here in Australia, is make me. make me. Like, it is too hard for them. It's quite difficult for them to do this. It's quite difficult for them to work out what's fake and what's real. And so, as Tobias said, it's a very hands-off approach where they say, well, what people post is not really our concern. And we saw this with kids accessing social media and paying for news here in Australia a little while ago, and the social networks eventually saying, no, we're not interested in supporting that. Go away, essentially, to the government. And so, yeah, I think they just have a lot of power to not moderate.
I'm curious as to why including fake satellite imagery being a part of this is so important.
I think it carries a lot of authority because it is kind of connected to, like, government eye in the sky or scientific fact. So when that starts circulating, it can be particularly misleading because everyone's like, oh, that's got to be real. That looks like science.
Now, there are organisations, obviously media organisations, ABC Verify in particular has also been actively working to debunk content around this conflict. But journalists are trained in this. We know what we're looking for. What can normal everyday people do to check whether something is real before they share it?
It is a really difficult problem. I mean, if we were talking about traditional media, if we were talking about somebody sharing a website or a news article or something, you would give them all of that usual digital literacy advice. You know, check the source, check to make sure that it's recent, check where what they're writing about came from, what were the references that the journalist used, right, to make sure that what you're reading is authentic. This is kind of standard information literacy, digital literacy advice. I think it's more difficult, as you said, with the satellite images, with these images that are generated, because they feel real. And often there's not a lot of sourcing. All you really have in front of you is an image that could conceivably have the ABC logo or the logo of some commercial network in the States. And so you believe it's true, or a satellite image that looks like it comes from the US government. So I'm not entirely sure what we do. It's a difficult challenge, this media literacy, where we can't believe the images and the videos that we see. It's a challenge. I don't know if Tobias has a silver bullet for us.
Not really. I mean, the silver bullet is don't go on social media, but I think that's a bit harder to kind of get around. I mean, there's plenty of misinformation on websites as well. So, check the source. Reverse image search is...
Well, that's a good one.
Kind of, it's not really a silver bullet, maybe a bronze bullet, but it kind of helps. And just check that the information is coming from a credible source and not just some random account.
Checking the source and thinking about who shared it with you as well is probably useful. Even if you look over it and you just kind of have a critical eye and don't necessarily share it, then you're going some way towards at least not propagating this fake news.
But one thing I would warn about is trusting AI. So when you Google if an image is real, if Google Gemini has seen a lot of people saying it's real, it's just going to repeat that. Mm-hmm. It's not going to fact check. That's not what they do. That might help.
Previously, you've been able to see that a video in particular was generated using AI because the clips are very short. A lot of the commercially available to the public tools that are accessible can't create clips beyond, say, 8 seconds. Have we improved on that? Is that something that we need to look out for? Or generally speaking, if the clip is quite short, that should be a red flag for us still?
I think people who are good enough at using this software can get around that being a tell that it's AI. You can edit together multiple clips that join up at the end, and it's totally fine. So it is feasible to have a long AI-generated video now, unfortunately.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Tobias Venus, who is a tech and travel journalist, and Professor Tech himself, Michael Cowling, Professor of Educational Technology at RMIT, and Director of the Hub for Apple Platform Innovation. And if you're struggling to tell the difference between what's real and what's AI, Ben Law has an episode of ABC Compass coming out soon that covers exactly that. Have a quick listen.
I have one final question for you. For the last time, human or bot?
This is weird. The bot has harvested my voice and replicated it. It feels surprisingly violating. But in the end, we do successfully spot the bot from the human.
Oh!
Yeah, I did not expect my voice to be spoken back to me and used as a weapon.
Yeah.
What a terrifying thing to realise I wouldn't even be able to tell myself in a deepfake.
Yeah.
That whole experience just showed me that very soon they will learn human quirkiness to the point that we won't be able to tell the difference.
Uh-huh. I actually felt a bit emotional when the AI took over your voice. Mm. It sort of made me tear up and I was a bit surprised at that. And I think it was because, yeah, I did trust myself less and I couldn't believe that it could do that to you.
Well, I think that feeling is perfect. The feeling that actually your own voice and how it identifies you feels really personal. Mm-hmm. I want people to leave this experience questioning what it is about being a human that they can't lose, mm-hmm. that they hold dear, that they value.
That's Ben Law's Compass episode called Outsourcing Our Souls. It airs on Sunday, the 15th of March. Now, for the last few years, hardware launches and announcements have been a bit boring, in my opinion, a bit grey, outside of concepts that we see at places like the Consumer Electronics Show. You know, gadgets have been a bit dull, but Apple has shaken things up a little with a new MacBook that's not only colourful, but by MacBook standards, quite cheap. Now, Professor Tech, how cheap are we talking here and how did they get the price down?
It is, I think, the cheapest Apple laptop ever. And I think maybe somebody will fact check me on that. But in the States, it's $599 for the laptop, $499 for education pricing. And that translates to $750 here in Australia. So anybody that's wandered into an Apple store before will know that a $750 MacBook is pretty unique and pretty unusual.
And this goes against the curve because we have seen hardware prices go through the roof. You know, things like tariffs and chip shortages are impacting anyone making anything in tech. How have they gotten the price down?
Part of it, I think, is economies of scale. Apple, one of the reasons hardware has gone through the roof is because of RAM prices. And Apple has charged for a little bit for RAM for a while. They've had a bit of buffer. And so they're able to wear that relatively well. And I think also in terms of buying those components, they just locked in components from suppliers. They have existing relationships with these big chip manufacturing companies and are basically able to say, we want millions of these chips. Can you please give us a good deal. This one, of course, particularly notable because it uses the chip that was in the iPhone 16.
That's
so they've
right.
already got a bunch of these chips being made and maybe still some in a box somewhere.
So what does running a MacBook on an old iPhone chip rather than the latest M series chips that we see in other MacBooks, what does it actually mean for someone using it day to day, Tobias?
I was pretty dubious when I first heard about this because I can't imagine a laptop running on a phone chip. But I had the iPhone 16 Pro. It was amazing. Early reviews are saying this one runs everything pretty well and even comparable to the M1 Macs that came out in 2020. I've still got an M1 Mac and it's amazing. So if it's comparable to that, that's a big thumbs up. The only difference I can imagine this not kind of hitting the benchmark is when you're doing really heavy stuff. Like I work a lot with video and photo workloads. Like that kind of stuff is probably going to require a little bit more processing power. But anything like doing emails, surfing the web, making AI videos maybe, you could probably get away with that on a device like this.
When you're looking at this MacBook, you're seeing all of the beautiful bright colours that it's coming out in. You're looking at that price, $750 here in Australia. And the student discount involved in that as well. Is that who Apple is going for here, Michael? Are they targeting that student market, do you think?
That's definitely who they're going for. And they've been in the education market for a long time. So it makes sense that they target this market. But a lot of people, a lot of those early reviews have suggested that this is the first time that they've really felt like they can make a MacBook that is not junk, essentially. and I think, as Tobias said, early reviews have suggested that's true. And I'm not really surprised because they've been building this architecture for over a decade. And in fact, architecturally, the iPhone chip and the MacBook chip are the same chip. They're both based on the ARM chipset. And they basically took the A series chip and when it got to a certain level, turned it into an M chip. So it's no surprise that as they continued to progress, they eventually went, well, we could put an A series chip in a in a Mac.
Yeah. It's really nice to be excited by a laptop. I haven't felt genuinely excited by a laptop in a very long time. I would love for you to tell me about some tech that brought you joy this week.
To go down the travel journalist wormhole, there's an app called Flighty. So with Flighty, basically imagine Qantas sends you your itinerary. You can forward that via email to Flighty and it will automatically add it to the app. When you travel, you can check the app and it not just gives you your flight details, it also gives you information about the plane, how old it is, where it's flying to, in like a minute by minute update. So you can just track where the plane is at any given time. It's often better than the airline's own apps. Now, I've been using this for a few years and taken hundreds of flights. So at the end of your year, you can check your stats and see your most sat in seat, your most flown aircraft model, and even if you've actually flown on the same plane multiple times.
What have you got for me? What tech's brought you joy this week?
Look, we've talked about it already. It's the MacBook Neo. The MacBook is a really interesting product because, as you mentioned earlier, it's Apple getting into a market that they haven't gotten into before. And I think, for me, it heralds a year of potentially Apple being a bit weird.
Michael Cowling, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you and your work?
Look, if you just Google Professor Tech, then that's a really good way to start. I have a YouTube channel, probably not as exciting as Tobias's, but the other place you can find me is LinkedIn. I post there all of the time.
Tobias Venus, where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, you can find my tech stuff at Tobias Venus. Just Google me. YouTube's probably the best place, and travel stuff on the Point Hacks YouTube channel.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, Meta has paid an undisclosed sum to acquire Maltbook, the social media platform for artificial intelligence agents to post and comment and vote on content. It went viral after a post appeared to show bots planning a secret language to communicate without human knowledge. It turned out to be a hoax, but not before Elon Musk called it the early stages of singularity. Speaking of Musk, Elon has unveiled a joint Tesla XAI system called MacroHard that combines his Grok AI with software he says can watch a screen and operate a computer like a human employee would. Musk claims it can, in principle, emulate the function of entire companies. That's a quote. The announcement comes as Tesla shareholders are currently suing Musk for building XAI as a separate company rather than inside Tesla. And in some good news closer to home, Melbourne researchers have built a shoe-sized robot that cleans up oil spills. It's called the Electronic Dolphin, and it skims across the water's surface, vacuuming up oil through a filter inspired by sea urchin spines, which repel water but absorb oil at over 95% purity with no toxic chemicals needed. The team's vision is fleets of dolphin-shaped autonomous bots doing the whole job on a loop. And that's all for this week. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss future episodes of Download This Show. And thank you so much for all of your kind thoughts and your wonderful feedback and your emails. You can email me at downloadthisshow, that's all one word, at abc.net.au, or you can always slide into my DMs over on Instagram at Ray Johnston. I am Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.